Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. The book considered to be the definitive work about Michael Jackson's fall from grace, Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case, just became even more explosive. Award-winning investigative journalist Diane Diamond first reported on the child sex crime allegations against Jackson back in 1993. Now she offers startling new revelations about the final years of Jackson's life as she adds four new bonus chapters full of her trademark in-depth reporting to her original blockbuster work. A well-connected and fearless investigative reporter known for her ability to communicate complicated stories in an understandable, common-sense way, an impressive career, former news anchor on NPR's All Things Considered, Capitol Hill correspondent, you've seen her on all the major networks, senior investigative reporter for Hard Copy, where she first reported on child molestation charges against Michael Jackson, Court TV once again breaking the story of another allegation of child sexual misconduct against the entertainer, author of Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case, now with four all-new bonus chapters, also an updated audiobook. Multiple award-winning journalist, author, syndicated columnist Diane Diamond is back with us on This Week in America. Diane, welcome back. It's great to have you with us on the program.
Wow, what an introduction, Rick. Thank you so much.
And I always feel like I'm leaving a couple of decades out of there. You've done so much. Sometimes we'll do like a two-hour program and I can do justice with everything that you've done. You're back.
I'll send you my long resume, and then you could just read that,
okay,
you know?
We could do that. There is so much there. It's so impressive. In fact, you go through that. It's like, okay, well, this is important. This is important. All of a sudden, you got three pages of everything that you've done. Back now, much national acclaim with the book, the four additional chapters, revealing exclusive new information. Let's start. You talked with, for the first time, one of the unindicted co-conspirators in the 2005 case. Who is Vinnie Amen, and what is his connection to Michael Jackson?
Oh, yeah, that's one of the new revelations I have in these new chapters. Vincent Amen was back in 2003 when the second round of allegations against Jackson came forward. A kid named Gavin Arvizo claimed he had been sexually molested. Vincent Amen worked for Michael Jackson. There was a group of people who got together to try to revitalize Jackson's career. And Vincent Amen, oh gosh, he was 21, 22 years old, very smart, a business major. He was convinced to come out to California from his home in New Jersey and work with Team Jackson. He was right in the middle of this project to revitalize Jackson's career when this second round of allegations hit. And as such, he, being sort of the low man on the totem pole, was tasked with doing a whole lot of things that were mentioned in the indictment against Jackson. It was a big conspiracy indictment. You know, you sexually molested a child, and then you got your underlings, the people who worked for you, to try to kidnap that family, to try to send them to Brazil. You checked the kids out of school, because the accuser had a brother and sister. You got them visas, you got them passports, and you were ready to ship these people out of the country. So it turns out it was Vincent Amen who did most of those chores, going to the passport office,
yes,
with the family, checking the kids out of school. So I got to know Vincent Amen, and he wanted to, frankly, unburden himself. And I tell his side of the story, what was going on, the panic within Team Jackson as these latest, then in 2003, the allegations rolled out.
It's so fascinating. He even tried to sabotage Gavin's medical records. I mean, they really were doing everything they could to make this go away. When you talked with him, you've got some great insight as to what was going on, the level of panic, just when they think maybe things are back and Jackson's career could take off again. Comes the second round of accusations. What was it like inside Team Jackson?
Well, according to Vincent Amen, there were three or four levels of people over him. A couple of Germans, a man named Frederick Mark Schaffel, who had been a gay pornography filmmaker, and a young man named Frank Cassio. Now, Frank Cassio had gone to high school with Vincent Amen back in New Jersey, and he's the one who convinced Vinny to come out to California and work on this project. he described to me a very systematic program, if you will, to alienate the Arvizo family, to keep them away from the media, to keep them away from police, frankly,
yes,
and to get them out of the country. And startlingly, he says the person at the very top, of course, was Michael Jackson, but he had hired Mark Garagus, the attorney.
Yes.
And Vincent explains these meetings that they all went into with Garagus, where this plan was hatched to literally kidnap the family, and how it was directed, according to Vincent Aumann, by attorney Garagus.
Now, this is interesting. There is so much, and I don't want to use the word startling too frequently during the course of our conversation today, but boy, that's the one that keeps coming to mind. With us on the program, Diane Diamond, author of the book, Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. The book is available at Amazon. As I mentioned, 4 new chapters. Look for the updated audio version at audible.com. If it's not there, it will be within a couple of days. Let's go back to what was going on behind the scenes. Who was actually calling the shots? Was it Garagus, you're saying?
Apparently, yes. According to Vincent Aumann, he had a plan. He knew what legally could hurt Jackson the most, and set in motion this idea that, okay, this is a poor family. There's no father in the picture, just the mother. They live in East L.A. Go take everything out of their apartment, close up their apartment, and put everything in storage. And then we got to get them visas and passports and get them out of the country. And who's going to do all this? And they all looked at Vinny, and they said, Vinny, you go do it. And he did it. Now, I feel that this kid has great remorse. I call him a kid. He's a grown man now with 2 young sons of his own. But there's a level of remorse, I guess. That is the best word. And he backs up everything, Rick, with documents and receipts and contemporaneous notes that he kept. Again, this was a very intelligent kid. And I said to him at one point, you know, they made you the scapegoat. And he said, oh, I realize that. I realize that now. Everybody hatched this big plan, and then I was the one who did the dirty work. So this was it was an inside look at how the operation operated, and it was a real eye-opener for me.
He also brought you an inside look inside the jury room. This is amazing. He shares something with you that he actually bought on eBay. Talk about that. You had an actual notebook from one of the jurors, so we're sort of in the jury room, in the courtroom, in their minds as they're going through the process of the trial.
Exactly. And not just one juror notebook, it was 6.
Oh, 6.
This one particular juror, I remember him, he was an alternate, and jurors are supposed to turn in their notebooks
at
the end of the trial.
Yes.
But they forgot to ask the alternates for their notebooks. So years passed, and this man put his notebooks up on eBay, and Vincent Aumann saw them there, and he said, I'm going to buy them. And I think he paid, I don't know, $1,500. I can't remember. It's in the chapter, but didn't pay much money. He got the 6 notebooks. He got the court-issued pens that the man used. He got his juror badge, and he got the certificate signed by Judge Melville. You know, thank you for your jury service,
yes,
blah, blah, blah. So that was another inside look, a real eye-opener into what at least this juror was thinking as the state's case against Michael Jackson was laid out. And I write about that detail. I quote his notebooks pretty extensively in one of my new chapters.
Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case by Diane Diamond, with 4 new chapters. We're talking about some of the highlights of those 4 chapters. The book is available at Amazon. She also is the narrator for the updated audio version. You'll find that at audible.com. That should be there within several days if it's not there by now. Let's go back and talk about the jury, because it's interesting what some of the jurors really felt Michael Jackson did molest children.
You know, it was one of the most, let's use that word again, startling
yes,
things that I discovered. There are 4 jurors who today say, you know, I think he did molest children. But in the jury room, they declare, the jury foreman was misinformed in pressuring them to vote not guilty. And by that I mean they are quoted as saying that this jury foreman said to everyone in the room and during deliberations, look, you cannot convict somebody just on testimony alone. You have to have a smoking gun. You have to have an eyewitness. You have to have some medical documentation to back it up, you know, some injury to the child. Well, that is nonsense. There, you know, child molesters, I could go on and on about pedophiles' behaviors. They don't do what they do in front of witnesses. They're very careful not to physically injure a child. And I don't want to get too graphic, but if it is a oral attack, there's no medical evidence. But this jury foreman apparently day after day after day kept insisting, I don't care what you think, you have to prove it with some smoking gun. And there isn't one. So they all voted not guilty.
It's interesting because we all think, what if Michael Jackson had been found guilty? Jermaine, his brother, had thought about that. And again, a startling revelation, what he was planning in the event that he was found guilty.
Well, get this. Jermaine Jackson later tells a reporter, well, you know, if my brother had been found guilty, I was prepared. I had a private jet at a nearby airstrip, and we were going to swoosh him away onto the jet and take him to a foreign country. If America didn't want him, then we wouldn't want him in America. Again, that is complete Jackson family spin nonsense. If Michael Jackson had been found guilty, the bailiff would have stepped forward, put his hands behind his back, handcuffed him, and marched him out of the room. They would have taken his costume and his wig and given him a prison garb and a number and put him in a cell. Jermaine would have been nowhere near his brother. But you see, it makes for a good Jackson family story.
That story and many, many more in Diane's book, Be Careful Who You Love Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Updated for startling, revealing new chapters in the book, the audio updated version as well, which Diane narrated. I'll give you more information on that here in a couple of minutes. Let's talk about what happened afterwards. This wandering all around the world, Michael, where did he go and what was life like for him during that period?
Yeah, you know, he really became a global nomad with his three children and the nanny, Grace. Her name is Grace Raumba. And it was a sad time, and I tried to recount it in as much detail as I possibly could, because you'd think the man was found not guilty. You'd think he would show the world, he would get back into the music business and make fabulous music again and show his children what a real showman was like on stage. But he didn't do any of that. He, of course, needed a rest after that arduous trial. So he went to Bahrain and was the guest, in other words, everything was paid for, by the Sheikh. The Sheikh had a production company and believed that Jackson had come there to record new music and they were going to do great videos and have a great business. Well, none of that ever happened. And then when his welcome ran out with the Sheikh actually sued Jackson to recover some of the money that he had given him. Jackson went to Ireland, stayed in a couple of places. One had a great production studio. Other talent came in to record with Jackson. But nothing ever happened. And, you know, as I was researching this, I realized the depth of his drug addiction just took a chokehold on Michael Jackson. He never recovered. It just got worse and worse. And according to Grace Raumba, there were times when he was absolutely anorexic, not eating, only drinking, only doing drugs. And she really feared for the safety of his children. And the children, by the way, love Grace. That was like their mother figure. So after Ireland, he then finds his way back to Las Vegas, where another sheikh puts him up in a big fancy villa they called the Thriller Villa. And there he had a Will.i.am, for example, came. They're going to record music. It was going to be great. But nothing ever happened. And so then, of course, as we all know, the AEG people, the big music production company, came knocking on the door, and they decided, he decided, all right, I'm going to pick myself up. I'm going to go do this last tour. He called it the This Is It tour. And he went back to Los Angeles, to the Beverly Hills area, where AEG put him up in a big, beautiful mansion with his children and Grace. But nothing ever happened, because as we know, that is where he died, with a needle in his arm with propofol. So it was a tragic tale, and dotted with a lot of interesting detail that actually I dedicate one whole chapter to that.
The book we're talking about is Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Diane Diamond, award-winning investigative reporter, our guest on the program. So much more to talk about. We're going to take a break now. We'll come back and talk about much more, including that half-hearted attempt to get his career going with a manager named twice, the same name. We'll talk about that after we come back on This Week in America, back after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.
Everybody wants cheap airfare, but where do you find it? You call low-cost airlines. Their prices are direct from the airlines, and they're so low you can't find these fares published anywhere. They specialize in cheap flights, discount hotel rooms, cheap car rental rates, and great package deals anywhere around the world. Wherever you want to go, they can help you get there cheaply and with the best price guarantee. If you want the lowest prices on your airline tickets or other travel services, call now. That's right, call. That's the only way to get these rates. Experts are standing by 24/7 to get you the cheapest airfare and hotel rates available. So don't wait. Call right now for the lowest travel prices anywhere and for great last-minute travel deals, too. Call right now. Operators are standing by. 800-298-0306. 800-298-0306. 800-298-0306. That's 800-298-0306.
Imagine this is your money and someone wants to take it from you. Who is it? The IRS. They want your money, and guess what? They can legally take it, all of it if they want. Remember, they sent you that letter that said, hey, you owe us a bunch of cash and we're going to take it from you. So what do? Fight back by letting our team of experts at the Tax Helpline work it out with the IRS so you can keep your money. And we're good at what we do. When you hire us, you get a team of guys on your side that know the IRS laws and will fight to save your money. So, if you owe the IRS a ton of cash and you want to keep it, call right now and learn for free how we can help you put it back in your pocket.
800-932-1597. 800-932-1597. 800-932-1597. That's 800-932-1597.